Hello and welcome to episode, 25 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. Wow. I'm Jerry Shario, and today we're going to be discussing the film Africa Screams. And it won't just be me. Along with me is the guy that makes all of this possible. Director, actor, playwright, musician, composer. Oh yeah, he does that too. A man who is so clever that sometimes even he doesn't understand what he's saying. Nick Santamaria.
Well, this for now, no, for this is about
No, I think we need to play it forward and not in reverse.
Oh, okay, because I had no idea what I was saying.
Well, that too, all right. Yeah.
Yeah, well, if you run it backwards, we'll find out that Paul has died. And we're not sure what color, but we'll get that back to you.
Yes.
So anyway, hi, Jerry. It's always a pleasure to see you, your visage.
Yeah. And you
even
as well.
Even though everyone else can't see it.
Yeah, well, that's their good luck, I guess, you know.
You're good lucking. Oh, that was terrible. Oh, my God, I started already. look, here's my imitation. Ah! You know what that was? That was Africa.
Oh, okay.
So Africa.
That was good. That was good.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, and when I thought I disliked the film more than I did, I already wrote jokes like, you know, Africa just screamed for a better script. But, you know, it's these crazy kids today with those nutty commercials. But, you know, interestingly, and we were talking about this before we went on the air, mm-hmm. I openly disliked this movie. And openly disliked. I'm putting an ED at the end. That sounds like a T. But in our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, Matthew writes the chapter about Africa Screams because he has an affection for the film. And I told him flat out that I didn't like it. I even wrote my little section at the bottom that I just didn't like it. I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that in 1977, this movie went into public domain. And to be honest with you, I had no idea it existed until Jim Mulholland's book came out in 1975, I believe it was. So I'd read about it, but I'd never seen it, didn't know it existed. And, you know, that was that. Eventually, I got a VHS version of it that looked like it was made by Helen Keller. And it just looked terrible. You know, it was like muddy and, you know, the mm-hmm. soundtrack was bad. And that ruined it for me. And I'd seen a few more since then, and it was the same kind of deal. Well, to be honest with you, some wonderful friend of mine actually sent me the restoration that they did at Classic Flicks in 2020, and I can't recommend it any higher. It is just absolutely stunning. It's gorgeous. The sound quality, the picture, everything about it. And I have to be honest with you, I don't think it's a great Abbott and Costello movie, but I enjoyed it. It definitely made the difference for me.
Yeah.
So in, first of all, old news. I want to get over this first before we move on. We get, or I get emails from our listeners, and oftentimes they are corrections or things like that, which I always appreciate. Because I can't know everything, right, Jerry? I can't know everything.
I would argue that point, but yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
Okay. I'll wait here while you argue.
He can. No, he can. Yes, he can. No, he can. Yes, he can. Okay, I'm done.
You're telling me. All right. you'll find your pink slip under your dress. All right. So we're talking about my friend got in touch with me. I had mentioned in a previous episode that Sherman Hemsley had passed away in a motel when he was doing dinner theater in Phoenix. Somebody corrected me and told me it was not Phoenix. It was El Paso.
Oh.
So he El Paso'd away in Texas. Thank you for that correction. And another correction was made. I mentioned the Broadway show Mexican Hayride as a Cole Porter show, but it was a dry thing. He did not have a hit, blah, blah, blah. Somebody told me, yes, there was one hit song called I Love You. And I know, I love you, I love you.
I love
not. A minor hit, I would say. I know several minors that sang it on the way down. So, but it was deeper. It was, I love you. I love you. Oh, is that Cole? It must be Cole Porter. Boy, that went somewhere, didn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately, it came back again.
I'm resilient. And Sicilian. And a cesarean. So anyway, okay, so we had Mexican Hayride. He corrected me. There is one song. Okay. And I was going to mention this in the actual podcast, but I forgot that John Hubbard and Virginia Gray were supposed to sing that song in the movie, but it was cut.
Oh.
So there you go. I knew about the song. I just didn't mention it. So thank you, though, for bringing it up.
So there was actually going to be a Cole Porter song in the movie version of a Cole Porter musical.
Exactly, which is very unusual for Hollywood.
Yes.
Right? And the other question is, yes, Abbott is spelled with two B's. No, I'm kidding. That's fine. Okay, let's move on to this movie, Africa Screams.
Yes.
This is interesting. It's got an interesting background full of interesting people. First of all, this was Abbott and Costello's second independent feature. Their contract allowed them to make one a year. This was their second. They hijacked everybody from Universal. That's why it looks so good. Especially, right? Charlie Barton is aboard. And yep. Charles Van Anger, their DP, was there and making it look beautiful. And they went to a different studio. This was the Nassour Studio. Nassour. Nassour. And that was owned by brothers, Edward and William Nassour. They were children of Syrian immigrants. Edward, who ran the studio pretty much, I hope I'm getting this right. Somebody will correct me, I'm sure, because I mixed them up. But anyway, let's just pretend. He runs the studio, but he became a businessman in L.A. first. He got involved with the air crash industry. There have been several lately, haven't there been?
Yes,
boy, that was a
yes.
Freudian slip. And not your pink slip either. Okay, so he got into that industry, and then he started becoming obsessed with stop-motion animation, and he started experimenting with it. And he claimed later that it took him 18 years to come up with this process called regiscope. And he partnered in 1940 with Walter Lantz, another Universal boy, mm-hmm. and they tried to make a film called Lost Atlantis, and they got Columbia Studios involved, and just like Hollywood, everything just kind of blew up, and it never happened. 6 years later, the two brothers buy 4 acres on Sunset Boulevard. That's expensive. Mm-hmm. And they built their own studio, a fully complete studio, working studio. They rented it out to television production. They rented it out to movies and whatever. And they only produced a couple of films themselves, putting their own money. And this was one of them. I think they regretted it to the dying days. Let me put it this way. William, the other brother, was the money man. He was very prominent in a California bank. Mm-hmm. And he was born in 1903. Eddie was the young brother. He was born in 1911. Anyway, he came up with a movie that he was trying to put together called Ring Around Saturn. And this would have like put the animation into this film and everything else. But another movie came out with pretty much the same story. It was called The Brave One, written by a hiding Dalton Trumbo. He was in Mexico writing the screenplay because of the communist thing going on in the country at the time.
Yeah.
And they sued The Brave One, and actually they won. They won $750,000. How about that? And he actually re-edited it, their movie, and released it as Emilio and His Magical Bull in 1975. Anyway, Ed was long dead by that time, and this is going to kill you. He used his regiscope animation process. He did the dinosaurs for a movie called The Lost Continent with Cesar Romero, and he used it in The Beast of Hollow Mountain, based on the designs of Willis O'Brien, the animator for King Kong, the original King Kong, made later, because they wanted to do it right, Ray Harryhausen, who loved Willis O'Brien, made Valley of Gwangi. That was the story. And I remember going to see that first run in the movies. I was 9 years old. So that is the background to the studio where they worked. Eddie would show up every so often and just scream at everybody. He couldn't understand why people were throwing pies at each other and why Abbott and Costello had this card game going on for 9 years, and why it was pandemonium, why Bobby Barber was like blacking up and pretending to be a native, and all of this stuff was going on around him, and he couldn't understand. They were going over budgets, and they were going over time. It was just a nightmare for him.
Wow.
And he kind of made that known, and that caused tension on the set, and it just made them want to be funny more. They just made them want to, to go crazy. So it was a contentious relationship with the studio heads. I just find that so funny. But anyway, Edward, this is horrible. I couldn't believe this. Edward Nasor passed away in 1962 at the age of 51. Do you know how?
No.
He stabbed himself in the heart.
Ew.
That's how he committed suicide. I just can't. You know, you're thinking, now how can I kill myself and maybe I won't feel it or whatever? I think I'll stab myself in the heart. Oh boy. Ugh. You know, I don't know. Abbott would have said, why aorta? sorry. That's terrible. Oh my God. See, we're doing this at night, folks. And this is like, we usually do this during the afternoon. So I'm a little wacky.
A little more so than usual. Yes.
More so than usual. Should I do my Pat Buttram again?
Oh no.
No, listen. So anyway, let's go to the writers. I love to talk about the writers.
Yes.
Without the writers, Abbott and Costello would do the movie anyway. But anyway. So here's a name. His name is Earl Baldwin, born in Newark, New Jersey, just like Jerry Lewis, in 1901. And he actually worked on Lost in a Harem as his first go-round with the boys. He was at Warner Brothers for 11 years, and he wrote some of my favorite pre-code films. So he was good. He wrote a lot of good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He passed away in 1970. So he got solo credit for this film. But uncredited were Abbott and Costello's new radio writers. And I want to talk about that. Martin Ragaway and Leonard Stern, they were partners at the time. They did great things together and great things separately as well. Martin Ragaway, born in 1923 in Brooklyn, New York, he came up with, along with Leonard Stern, he came up with their second radio show. When they left NBC, they went to ABC, which was a kind of considered a new, almost lesser network, but it was building. It was building, and they had Bing Crosby. So, you know, it had a future, let's put it that way. But it was also the home of the new technology, which was transcriptions. They would record on tape and then edit, and also sweeten laughter and all of that other stuff. I feel like I hear that in the newer ABC shows, even though I could be wrong. It could be, you know, the actual audience, and you do hear the actual audience reacting. I'm just wondering if they sweeten it a little.
Yeah.
But the material is new. They're not doing old routines. They're not doing their basic burlesque routines. They're doing new material, and I love that. I really enjoy listening to that. But the main thing they came up with was Sam Shovel.
Yes.
Sam Spade, of course. Lou fell in love with this segment, and he wanted a whole radio show based on Sam Shovel, honestly. But it was him doing the, you know, Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler. It was a great day in San Francisco, and da ba da ba da ba da. And Bud is the cop who's working with him, and you know, it's just one horrible pun after another. It's fantastic. I really love it. It's new blood. It. It's fresh, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's fresh. Yeah. It's not the same stuff. So anyway, that was good for Martin Ragaway. Passed away in 1989. Now, Leonard Stern.
Mm-hmm.
Leonard Stern, first of all, both of them were uncredited on this one, but they were credited on Foreign Legion, which is coming up the following year, and Lost in Alaska, also coming up the following year. Let's see. Leonard Stern got into television in a very big way. Very big with Steve Allen, writing those sketches and all that stuff. He also, with a friend of his, Roger Price, came up with Mad Libs. He invented Mad Libs. I can't tell you how many hours of laughter that supplied during my childhood. You too, Joe?
Oh, yes, yes. Still, I love it. My goodness.
I still do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great stuff. And they came up with that. So what else? He was a major in journalism originally at NYU. Did I say when he was born? 1922 in New York City. Okay. Lived till 2011. His first solo film writing was The Bowery Boys' Let's Go Navy. But he was so embarrassed that he he changed his name to Max Adams just for that movie. I like that one. It's very good. Habanaka! The great thing about him, and this you're going to appreciate, he was married to Julie Adams for 2 years.
Ooh.
So he got the creature's girl, the creature from the
yes. Black
Booker, in that white bathing suit. I just want to jump up and down. So he got that. But anyway, he worked on Get Smart and won Emmys, and he wrote on the Dean Martin roasts. And his very last job was the Billy Crystal Comedy Hour in 1982. Never heard of it.
No.
But anyway, he lived a long time. He lived to 2011. So those are our writers, and a good group they are too. Another producer, someone who came in to help fund this film, was one of the richest men in the world. Or maybe American, maybe just American. Maybe I guess I took in too much ground. Huntington Hartford. Mm. Huntington Hartford. Now, I remember I went to that theater in Los Angeles many times, the Huntington Hartford Theater, also born in 1911. He was the heir to the A&P supermarkets. No. Very, very wealthy. He would be even more so now with the price of eggs.
Yes.
He produced James Whale's final film in 1950 called Hello Out There, which I've never even heard of. And he wrote and produced, this fascinated me, and I would give my left arm to see this, but he wrote and produced a stage adaptation of Jane Eyre, called it The Master of Thornfield. It ran for 2 weeks in Cincinnati before it closed, and it starred, are you ready, Errol Flynn.
Wow.
I would have given my left arm to
see. Oh. Yes.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that would have been something. So anyway, so Huntington was pretty fascinating, and he passed away in 2008, so he lived for quite a long time as well. The composer of the score is also interesting. His name is Walter Schumann, and he wrote the score for Charles Laughton's classic film, maybe in my top 10, Night of the Hunter. Beautiful, haunting score. And he came up with, are you ready? Bum, 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 bum. That's right, the theme from Gunsmoke.
Yeah. And,
well, this is a web series. So he wrote the Dragnet theme. And he was born in 1913, passed away in 1958. He was only 44 years old, and he had a bad heart, and he died after a very early version of open heart surgery. And it makes me think of Harpo. Harpo, 20 years later, had the same operation, and it was just as risky 20 years later. I mean, he died, obviously, but you know what I'm saying. So he was a victim of that. But boy, he wrote some fun stuff, eh?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's get to the movie itself. I'm going to get to the various players as we get to them, because I feel like that's the most fun. It's like a little road map.
Yes.
And map is very important to this film. This is kind of fun to me, because I have to say, this movie has been like a, I don't want to say a thorn in my side, but it's been the one that I always say I don't like.
Yeah.
In fact, I say it's one of my two least favorite of their films. And I don't know if I could say that anymore. You know, the other one we haven't gotten to yet.
Okay.
We'll get to it. But this one, I just thought it was very ragtag. It reminded me of the TV show. And again, I was looking at these horrible prints of it, and it looked very low budget. I felt like they wasted Shemp and Joe Besser. You know, another reason, and I can tell you this, this makes more sense to me too, is the fact that this trope, the jungle comedy, had been really done to death. You know, for me personally, I'm not talking about by the time they made this movie, but I had already sat through Wheeler and Woolsey and So This Is Africa, the Bowery Boys in Jungle Gents, the Three Stooges numerous times, running around a fake jungle, Brown and Carney and Zombies on Broadway. I mean, there were all these jungle, you know, movies. And on top of that, I'm a big fan of the Tarzan movies as well. So I'm pretty used to these, you know, let's put these plants on the set and we'll pretend we're walking through the jungle. So it didn't thrill me all that much. But again, like I said, seeing it now was kind of like seeing it for the first time. I don't want to overdo it because it wasn't great. But there were some moments, man, where I was laughing. Then we'll talk about that. And I have a feeling, Jared, you and I are very on the same page about something. All right. So the movie was originally thought to, they were thinking about shooting it in Cinecolor. That's a two-strip, cheaper than Technicolor. But that was abandoned because it would have cost more money. That's why it was abandoned. I have to say, I don't even like the drawings during the opening credits. they're okay.
They look cheap. I'm sorry, but
and that's what I'm trying to avoid saying.
They do. Well, I won't, because they do. They especially compared to some of the other opening title sequences that they've had up to this point.
Universal International. Well, the money is copious. But anyway, it does. It looks kind of cheap. But I do like the he wrote some authentic sounding African music. It sounds like the music from Road to Zanzibar, you know, that which was also very authentic sounding. There was even like native singing on the soundtrack, you know. There were actually six of us here doing that. You can't see. You know, I used to make myself laugh doing John Wayne speaking Swahili.
Oh my gosh.
Kola tila fala kaka la masula bala no. It just makes me laugh. I don't know why.
I think because he says kaka.
Kakaluna. All right. Boy, people are really learning about this movie right now, aren't they? So the opening scene is just adorable. It's Lou with a whip and a gun, and he's wearing a safari outfit. He's got a pith helmet on, and there's like bushes behind him. It looks like bushes. And he's, you know, whipping it and telling it, you calm down, you stay and sit up and all this stuff. He's giving it orders. And then you cut and you see that it's a baby kitten. And it's so cute. It is a cute kitten. But Lou is deathly afraid of animals, even this baby kitten. So he, is this where he falls? Where he falls into the lady and her leg?
Yes.
Yes. I don't remember why he fell. How does he fall? What causes?
He's running away from the baby kitten.
From the baby kitten who lunges and he runs. Okay. And he crashes into this lady. And this lady's laying on the floor. She has a dress on. And you see her leg come unattached from her body. And it turns out that it's a mannequin's leg, and it's Lou's reaction is very funny. Basically, it was a Harry Langdon gag from Mack Sennett back in the 1920s. But, you know, that happened all the time. So anyway, he calls for his friend Buzz, and you know who that is. It's our buddy Bud. Why are you so afraid of animals? What is with you? And you know, he's just afraid. He said his piggy bank scared him when he was a baby, and he was 15 by the time he had his first animal cracker. So he's afraid. He's really afraid. So our plot gets going here. We have, first of all, audience favorite, and let's pause here for a nice sigh, Hilary Brooke. Tall, stately, elegant, gorgeous. People don't know whether she was – in fact, I read two sources tell me that she was born in Brooklyn and another one saying Astoria, Queens. not much of a difference, but she was something else. And most people thought she was British. She did go to, well, let me start at the beginning. Her real name is Beatrice Sophia Matilda Peterson. And she's of Swedish extraction. I was going to say distraction. And in her case, that's true.
Very, yes.
You're right, distracting. Mm-hmm. Born in 1914, she attended Columbia University, got into modeling, spent a year in Europe, especially in the UK, where she acquired that accent, and came back to America and was hired by RKO, doing mostly uncredited stuff. I remember spotting her in New Faces of 1937. Can you believe that? 1937. This is like a few years before she really did anything. Mm-hmm. But that was a fun movie, by the way. Joe Penner. I love Joe Penner. And also Park Your Carcass, Albert Brooks' dad and Super Dave's dad. Yeah, really fun movie. Lots of fun. So, and Hillary, coincidentally, worked at Universal. And she did three Sherlock Holmes films, Sherlock Holmes and the Voice of Terror, Sherlock Holmes Faces Death, and Woman in Green. She was with Hope and Crosby in Road to Utopia. She was with the Bowery Boys. You hear that, Leonard Stern? In a movie called Lucky Losers. And she was in Invaders from Mars very prominently. Also in The Maze, a 3D movie. The Maze. She's in an I Love Lucy episode in 1956, The Fox Hunt. That's when they moved to Connecticut, I believe, or it could be when they're in England. And she got out of it pretty much towards the end of that decade, the 50s, and married ex-MGM executive Ray Clune and lived very comfortably to the age of 80. She passed away in 1999. And it, coincidentally, she her agent was Eddie Sherman.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about that? So anyway, we meet Hillary. She comes into Klopper's department store and approaches Bud. She's looking for the book Dark Safari by Cuddlesford. They all know it, too. Do you have Dark Safari by Cuddlesford? Apparently, it was a very popular book. No one has a copy of it, not even Bud and Lou at the department store, the book department. So she offers $1,000 to anyone who could copy the map that is found in that book, because she wants to find something. We don't know what it is yet, but she's looking for something and she wants to find someone. Bud hears $1,000 and has an orgasm. So, and he's like, oh, really? Okay, well, I have someone who knows that book like the back of his hand and he can draw that map for you, blah, blah, blah. So she gives him his card and says, okay, be here at 8 o'clock and blah, 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 we'll settle it up. Okay, so he's very excited. In the meantime, while this is going on, two behemoths who are actually henchmen of Hillary, who is a very evil character in this, by the way. Mm-hmm. But these two guys, you've got Max and Buddy Bayer, two enormous fellows. Let's put it this way. Buddy himself is 6'8". And they are also looking for the book and the map, and they approach Lou. And Lou tells him, no, we don't have it, but I know that book very well. And they offer him $2,500 if he could copy the map. So he makes a deal, and he's going to meet them. And again, they're both going to the same place. Bud finds out that Lou negotiated for more money, so he's even more interested. And they show up at Hillary's house. As they're walking up to Hillary's house, this is funny. This is one of the parts that makes me laugh. Mm-hmm. As they're walking into Hillary's house, Lou looks down and there's a faucet, an outdoor faucet, and it's leaking. So he bends down to turn it off. And he's trying, and it's very difficult. And Bud's at the door, you know, and he's like, would you hurry up? Come on. And he's like, but the faucet is leaking. And he says, well, my, and then he gets his finger caught in it. And he says, well, my finger's caught. And he says, well, leave it there. Come on. Bud. So the next thing we know, Lou has the faucet attached to his finger the whole time. And he's trying to get it off the whole time. Okay, so the butler at Hillary's place is our friend, Mr. Joe Besser. And we all know, we Abbott and Costello fans love him as Stinky. We Three Stooges fans don't especially love him as a stooge. But, you know, he did add sort of a different energy to it when the Stooges needed it, to be perfectly frank. Personally, I think they should have broken up after Shemp passed away. I think nothing they did afterwards was worth staying around for. But anyway, other than their live television stuff, which was wonderful. So Joe Besser, boy, oh boy, you know what his real name was?
What's that?
Jessel Besser. It's almost like a, you know, like a, not a tongue twister, but, you know, Jessel Besser, Jessel Besser, say it 90 times fast, and I'll go get a sandwich. Born in 1907 in St. Louis, Missouri, he is a distant relative of Steve Stolyar, who worked for Groucho and wrote that book, Raised Eyebrows, and was
really?
A friend of mine. Yeah, he was a friend for 35 years of mine before he fired me. we had a little difference of opinion, and we haven't spoken in almost 10 years now. But, you know, that's ridiculous, and that's here and there. Steve, if you're listening, and I doubt you are, stop it. Okay, let's just stop. Okay. All right, so Joe Besser, born in St. Louis. And you figure St. Louis, Mo. Huh? Mm-hmm. That's a harbinger of things to come, I believe.
Yes, yes.
No one ever said that before. This podcast gives you that information. He had 8 siblings. And when he was 12 years old, he actually stowed away with a magician, Howard Thurston, and became a part of this guy's act at 12 years old. Wow. And he started touring in vaudeville, and he became the comic side of it. You know, he would screw up tricks and all that stuff. So he got his first, experience. Eventually, Olsen and Johnson, the most dangerous comedy team of all time, hired him for their follow-up to Hell's a Poppin', which was Sons of Fun, another big hit. And he worked for them for a while. He was actually signed to a personal contract by Jake Schubert of the Schubert Corporation. Mm. And eventually they sold it to Hollywood, to Columbia Studios, where he made a couple of features. Hey Rookie, which was made possible again by Abbott and Costello's success. And Edie Was a Lady and other B movies at Columbia. He also did short subjects there. He teamed up with a guy, and veteran Los Angeles people are going to know about this. In the 1950s, there was a radio personality by the name of Hawthorne. He went by the name of Hawthorne. And Columbia, in its wisdom, decided to team Hawthorne and Joe Besser. And I think they made like 4 shorts together, or maybe 6. I don't remember, but I've seen a few of them with Hawthorne. And he's like this tall, kind of heavy set guy with glasses. And he's, you know, it's almost like there's 2 pansy characters. You know what I mean? He's a little bit that way, but Joe is a lot that way. But the two of them together, it's a little much.
Yeah.
But, you know, Joe makes solo stuff at Columbia. He's there. And that's why they hired him after Shemp died, because it was so convenient. But anyway, I love him in the Abbott and Costello show. I think it's the best work he ever did, as Stinky. And we don't know, you know, discussions are made around tables. Is he an actual child with a thyroid problem? Or is he a somewhat retarded man? He thinks he's a 10-year-old. I don't know. I really don't know. But I would say that his mother dressing him in a little Lord Fauntleroy costume does sort of inspire him to go in a certain direction. So we have the wonderful work between him and Lou in the Abbott and Costello show. And then he shows up with the Stooges. He did their last, I believe it was their last 12 features, and they're very weird. They go into science fiction, into space travel, reincarnation. I mean, you know, even combing Mo and Larry's hair back, you know, to making them look almost human. And then he shows up on the Joey Bishop show as a regular, as the janitor. I forget his name, but he's the janitor, and he's very good in that, and he shows up a lot. And Joey loved him. He used to have him on his talk show, too. And then towards the end, very comfortably, he worked constantly doing voiceovers for Hanna-Barbera and other companies, and he would show up in places. I got to meet him in 1983 at the Stooges, when they got their star on Hollywood Boulevard. He was the only one representing the boys, and I met Emil Sitka that day. He was very kind. But afterwards, there was a big screening of a documentary about the Stooges, and that's where I met Joe. That's where we got together. I have a great picture of the two of us, and I'm actually wearing a Curly t-shirt standing next to me. But But he was so sweet. He was such a dear man.
Nice.
So yeah, and he passed away in 1988, 5 years after I met him. I hope I wasn't responsible. So yeah, he's going out and he does that ad lib thing. He's behind the bar. She tells him to go answer the door. And he says, oh, do I have to? And she says, yes, you have to. And he's like, oh, I got to do it. And he's just like muttering to himself.
Yes.
And there's nothing clever about it. There's nothing funny about it, except the fact that he's muttering. So he opens the door and he welcomes the boys and they hand their hats. Lou's hand with the faucet attached is under his hat. And he hands the hat to Joe, and they walk away. And Joe removes the hat from his hand, and he's got the faucet stuck to his finger. And he doesn't know how it got there, and he's trying to get it out through the next 10 scenes. So, and it has a really great finish, too.
Yes.
But also not original. And I'll tell you why. But after a while, Lou tries to help him. You know, get it up, move your hand. He kept saying, move your hand, get your hand out of the way. Would you get your hand out of the way? Finally, he turns the faucet and the water comes out and squirts Joe in the face. So the water is attached somehow to his finger. It really is. It's a surprise. It's very surprising. Yep. But Harry Ritz did it in Pack Up Your Troubles in 1939.
Okay.
and you know what? It was probably done before that. But anyway, that's the one I know. So he lets the boys in, and this is it. This is where all the plot comes into play. The two behemoths, the two bear boys, they approach her and tell what happened about Lou and that he offered $2,500. So this is what they're going to do. They're going to get Lou to draw the map. They're going to give Bud and Lou the $2,500. Bud and Lou are going to leave with the money, and then the two behemoths are going to attack them and take the money back, maybe even kill them. This is what I mean about Hillary. She's not exactly, you know, a little Mary Sunshine. So this is the plan. Now, in the meantime, Bud has a habit in this movie. He has you might say, habit in Costello. He eavesdrops quite a bit. He eavesdrops through this entire film.
Yes.
And if he didn't, it wouldn't move. There wouldn't be anything going on. You know, he finds out that they're double crossing him. He's got to do something. That's proactive. So he listens in and he hears Hillary talking to Clyde Beatty. Now, who's Clyde Beatty? The man with the beady eyes. So Clyde Beatty, he was a very famous animal trainer, born in 1903. He was born in Bainbridge, Ohio. He became a cage boy for an animal trainer at the age of 18 with Howe's Great London Circus. He opened his own circus in 1945, and that lasted till 1956. That's how long he was involved with it, the Clyde Beatty Circus. I know the Cole brothers teamed up with them later. And then due to this film, Africa Screams, more interest was built up in him, and he got his own radio show from 1950 to 1952, the Clyde Beatty Show. Yeah, and it kind of reenacted his adventures, and he didn't play himself. It was Vic Perrin, an actor named Vic Perrin. So Clyde couldn't even be himself. There was a big famous thing in 1957 on the Ed Sullivan Show. Before he went on, he realized that the stage was too small for what he had to do with the lions in the cage. Mm-hmm. And Ed was like, well, don't worry about it. You're a fine, fine youngster right here on our show tonight. And he didn't do anything about it, and it became a nightmare. he was right about it, and he managed to make everything right, but it was quite something. It made all the papers and everything really big. He was mauled a few times, once very seriously, but he overcame it, and that's it. He passed away in 1965 at the young age of 62. Yeah. So that's Clyde, and he's here, and he's a lousy actor. And
which is probably why they got Vic Perrin to play him on the radio show.
I would say it's more probable than that. but anyway, so Bud overhearing that she is paying Clyde to lead the safari, $5,000 now and $15,000 after the completion of the safari, $20,000. dollars. Yep. But hears this and realizes that they're playing small potatoes with them, and they couldn't do anything without the map. So he's got the hand. He's got the upper hand. They're not going to deliver the map until later, until they're, she agrees that they come along on the safari. Bud just feels there's something going on that he needs to be part of. Mm-hmm. Lou is not happy about it. So here, Lou has this scene now with Clyde Beatty. Now, Lou is not Lou in this scene. Lou is trying something new. It's new Lou for you. He's got this whole new braggart attitude. It's even a different delivery. Did you notice that, Johnny?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
At one point, he says something like, oh, gad, no, that's not, you know, that's wrong. We go out with lions. I love the way he pronounces lions. It's New Jersey, lines. As if you're drawing lines, that's how he pronounces it. Oh, no, no, no doubt about it, my friend. We are hunting big cats, big cats. And he goes on to say, and you've heard of Clyde Beatty, right? I do all the animal training for him. And he's bragging and bragging. And finally he goes, by the way, what's your name? And he's like, oh, Clyde Beatty. And he goes, ah, yes, Clyde Beatty, Clyde. That's great. Because, and then he does this amazing fall off the chair. But my favorite thing is he can't speak. He's so embarrassed. He's so overcome. He can't find words. And he points to himself and he makes the small a gesture with his forefinger and his thumb. Me, I'm tiny. You're big. You're very, very funny. That's funny stuff. Mm-hmm. And then Bud comes in and starts the whole thing all over again. And Lou's trying to get his attention. No, this is Clyde Beatty. So anyway, Hillary comes in and Clyde Beatty excuses himself. And the boys talk business. And that's where Bud says, we'd like to come along. We'll come along. We'll bring the map. You know, and then we'll settle up and we'll do it for 5,000 now and 15,000 later. So Bud's got the upper hand. And the very next scene is the map of them in Africa already. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the whole montage of them, you know, the line going on the map, you know, their route.
Yep.
And the scenes of animals, you know, probably from movies made 30 years before. they're finally in Africa and they're on safari. And I want to talk about a little bit about Max Baer, if I can.
He's along
with his brother Buddy, and his brother Buddy was his buddy. Max Baer Sr., real name Maximilian Adelbert Baer Sr. I find it interesting that he's got a great combination. He's part Scottish and part Jewish. His his paternal grandfather was Jewish.
Wow.
Which is weird. The movie Cinderella Man, about his fight with James Braddock, they kind of made him a racist or something. They made him villainous, and he wasn't. Mm. And Max Jr. got really angry about this. He was a lovable guy. He wouldn't hurt any, you know, outside of the ring. But anyway, I felt bad for Max. Mm. On that. But anyway, he was champ from 34 to 35. Ring Magazine rated him number 22 for the hardest puncher out of the 100 of the hardest punchers in boxing. Yeah. He was number 22.
Wow.
He had an unfortunate experience in the ring in 1933 with Frankie Campbell. He actually killed him in the ring. He actually loosened his brain in his head. That's how hard a hitter Max Baer was. Yeah, and he never overcame that. He would have nightmares. He would cry. A horrible, horrible thing. He would regularly send money to the widow. And you know, it was just a terrible, terrible thing. And then again, later, I forget who it was. Who was it? Not Braddock. There was another fighter that he fought who four fights after Max died. So you really can't blame Max for that, but Max blamed himself.
Yeah.
So anyway, speaking of Max, he also beat Max Schmeling in 1933, that a man with Jewish blood beat the Nazi favorite. That was very, very big at the time. Quite a boost for the Jewish community. He beat Primo Canera to win the championship in 1934. Now, Primo was from Italy. And they made him up. The mob was behind him. The mob was behind him, and they fixed every fight. He didn't know how to box. He was a big lummox who didn't know how to box. But anyway, he lost the fight, and our man became champion. He lost to Joe Lewis, and yeah, boy, he got nailed by Lewis. Lewis kicked the crap out of him. And yeah, in 1934, he was called by MGM to make a movie, to star in a movie. He was a good-looking guy, big, yeah. wavy hair, dark, good-looking guy, lots yeah. of personality. And he made a movie called Prize Fighter and the Lady with Myrna Loy. And in the movie, they redo the Primo Canera fight. Primo is actually there. It's a terrible movie. It's actually a musical. And Max actually does a number with the chorus girls. It's pretty embarrassing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty awful. but eventually, this is what I love about him. Eventually, he teamed up with Maxie Rosenbloom, Slapsy Maxie Rosenbloom, who mm-hmm. was the lightweight champion for a while, for 2 years. And the two of them did a nightclub act together. And of course, Jules White caught sight of it and put them in some shorts together as a team. Yeah. And Slapsy actually wrote a movie called Skip Along Rosenbloom. And Maxie's in that as well. It's like a Western spoof. Yeah, I got to get a hold of that somehow.
Yeah.
So, and Max died young. He died, he was 50 years old when he passed away from a heart attack. That's a shame. His son, though, hilarious. His son was the reason for me to watch Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh, yeah.
With Jethro. He was hilarious. anyway, so yeah, he also showed up on the Abbott and Costello TV show. On the second season, he played Killer. And, yeah, his last words were, "Oh, God, here I go." How about that?
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, not bad. Not bad. Not a bad way to go out. All right, so they're in Africa, and they are looking for stuff. And they are in the man-made lake or river in the studio itself, in the largest stage, sound stage on the Nasser lot. And it was filled with 200,000 gallons of water mixed with condensed milk. Now, that's how you get the water to show up that way. In fact, they say in Singing in the Rain that it wasn't rain. It was milk. And I still wonder how they strapped the cows to the ceiling. You know, it's just weird, a weird job.
One of Hollywood's secrets, yeah.
Yeah, Hollywood secrets, definitely. And it was a musical. So anyway, they're in the thing, and Lou does the whole thing with Ernest. Now, Ernest is the alligator, the universal tech people, actually made for the film. And it actually looks pretty good, I think, as far as phony alligators are concerned. But don't you think it should be a crocodile? It's Africa, right?
I would think so, yes.
I would think, but I think it's an alligator. I don't know. One of our people, if you're going to correct me, do it now. So, yeah, they're going along, and Lou and Bud are, you know, they do an old joke.
You know, Stanley, suppose a north wind should come up, what would you do?
I'd throw out an anchor.
If a west wind came up, what would you do?
I'd throw out another anchor.
And a south wind came up, what would you do then?
I'd throw out another anchor.
And an east wind blew up, what would you do?
I'd throw out another anchor.
Where are you getting all the anchors?
The same place you're getting all the wind.
You keep quiet.
That's what they put in. And, you know, as they're doing it, I'm just thinking, you know, Charles Barton must be shaking his head. You know, if I know Abbott and Costello, they probably put in, you know, a different joke each take. That's what I imagined. So anyway, they're in the thing, and Lou sees the alligator and, of course, does his scared stuff. And he grabs a mixer.
An egg beater.
And he puts it behind their boat and spins it, and of course they take off fast. One of the shots in this now are the rest of the safari coming down the man-made river, and there's one boat that has boxes stacked high, and on top are Joe Besser and Shemp Howard.
Yeah,
and it's really them, and you can see Shemp sort of fidgeting because he's getting a little seasick. He wasn't great with water. And you see him fidgeting a little bit, but you got to look quick. You really have to look quick. And apparently they broke for lunch and left him up there at one point as a joke. Yeah, I know. But the other thing I wanted to tell you before I forget about Hillary was petrified about doing this movie. And she went to Eddie Sherman and, you know, said, what am I going to do? The talk in Hollywood is that it's impossible to work with them. They never give you cues. And I'm an actress, you know, I'm used to getting my cues and work. And he says, don't worry about it. You'll get used to it. Just wait until they stop talking, then say your line, you know, and you'll get used to it eventually. And eventually you're going to have a great time. And I want to tell you, out of all the people I've read about in interviews and things like that, she had the best time with them. Mm. She just, you would not imagine this austere, gorgeous, statuesque blonde, you know, being into all this crazy stuff. She loved every minute of it. And she loved working with Lou. She loved it. She learned how to do it and she loved it.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say that. And I'm glad she got the role because not only was Barbara Britton considered to play this role, but are you ready? Frances Langford.
What?
Yeah, I say no.
No.
Sorry.
No.
Good in the Bickersons, excellent voice, but no.
Yeah, no.
I'll take Hillary. All right, so they did the gag with the egg beater, and I'm looking at my notes because this is another movie that I don't know like the back of my hand. Yes, there's a gag in the movie. And it came about just as I was saying, boy, are they wasting those two stooges? And it's a simple gag where Shemp, who is wearing his Coke bottle glasses, he's doing his blind character, which he does in other things as well, other movies. But anyway, he's doing this and he's supposed to be tying a rope around a post. And Joe is standing there and instead he ties it around Joe. And Joe's like, you don't tie it on my leg, tie it on the post. Ooh, you're such an asshole. But I'm sorry. I really am. But it was the first thing that came to mind. I had to shake my head and think, that's the gag they gave them?
Yeah.
They have two stooges in the room, and that's the gag they gave them? And it's interesting to note that Shemp was a stooge. They had just finished shooting for Crimin' Out Loud, and he shows up to work with Abbott and Costello for the sixth time, I think this was. But they did not give him a whole bunch to do. And it's a shame because his character is very funny. Anyway, he does a few bits, you know, with the monkey later on and all that. So they find out eventually Bud is eavesdropping again. And there are diamonds involved. And he hears this and that's it. Forget it. You know, his head jumps off his body, spins around and jumps back. <He's> complete with sound effects. But I think I hurt myself. But he hears about these uncut diamonds that they're looking for and they know they're in the area. So Bud is like, you know, his radar's up. He finds out about the diamonds and he comes back. And he's telling Lou all about, you know, there's diamonds and I'm going to be able to buy this and I'm going to be able to buy that. And he says, at one point, he says, just think about it. Winters in Maine, summers in Florida.
And I was like,
did he make a mistake or was that the script? I can't tell.
He delivers it so genuinely and heartfelt.
So yes. I had to ask myself, is that a mistake? Is he, you know, did he have a stroke? What's going on? but, you know, and then he talks about polo ponies. What would Bud Abbott have to do with polo ponies? I'm going to buy polo ponies. What?
Yep.
No, he's not. So anyway, he's all head up about these diamonds. He's going to be rich, blah, blah, blah. Of course, he doesn't mention Lou at all. Lou says, well, what about me? And he goes, well, yeah, here's a nickel. He gives him a nickel. So this is where we find out where the boys are really in trouble. The map that Lou supposedly knows like the back of his hand is really a map to Clopper's department store. It's his map getting from home to the store. And he used to keep it in that book, Dark Safari by Cuddlesford.
Yep.
So that's the map he draws. And Bud looks at it and says, what are you doing? You know, and he's like, well, that's I keep it in the book. It was the map in the book. So Lou was telling the truth.
Yep.
And he wondered why they were giving him $2,500 at the start for a map to a store that they were already in. So anyway, there's one point also he does something that I like. He comes out of the tent and he's yelling at the two behemoths, but they're not there. And he's whispering.
Getting sick and tired of getting pushed around by you guys. Did you hear me? Getting sick and tired of it. Hey, come on back. Come on back. Hey, come on back. Hey, come on back.
He won't raise his voice. It's very cute. It's a nice thing. And then Bud comes out and Lou takes out his gun and Bud's like, no, you can't do that to them. And he's like, I gotta do it to somebody. And he turns around and he squirts him with a water gun, which was inspired, by the way, by Mexican Hayride, where Lou went out and bought 11 water guns and gave them to everybody on the set. And it was a big water gun fight all through that shoot. This was probably an extra water gun. So anyway, they're talking about their options at one point. They're in the tent and they're talking about their options. And Joe Besser keeps running into the tent to the water bag, filling a little cup of water and running out again. And he does this like 3 times while Bud and Lou are talking. And finally, Bud stops him and says, what are you doing with all the water? And he goes, ooh, my tent's on fire. And he hits him, on the arm and runs out. Now, this bit was first done in Olsen and Johnson's Sons of Fun, and it always stopped the show. And he did it quite a few times. He even does it on the Abbott and Costello TV show. Yeah. Funny stuff, really funny stuff. And I like the way the scene ends where Lou gives him the little hit on the arm, like Joe Besser. And interestingly, Joe Besser in his book, Not Just a Stooge, actually talks about meeting Lou backstage at a certain theater in 1928. And Lou telling him, oh, I really like your stuff and blah, blah, blah. And he was really inspired by it. But if you did any research, you realize that Lou was in Hollywood in 1928 and that Joe didn't play that theater in 1928. It was 1923, blah, 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 blah. So you can't trust anyone.
Yeah.
But they were very close friends. And Lou was inspired by him. You could see it in his performances. A lot of people will say, a lot of misinformed people would say that he was inspired by Curly. No, he was inspired by Joe Besser. And not completely. I mean, he didn't steal anything, but he had that sort of, that thing he appreciated in Joe.
Yeah.
Yeah, not a big deal. Not a big deal. So anyway, at one point, Lou is walking in the forest and he sees someone is caught in a trap, in a pit. And there's a rope nearby, of course. He thinks it's Bud, and he's pulling it up, and he's pulling it up, and it turns out to be a gorilla. And, the gorilla actually develops kind of a crush on Lou, a sort of a bromance. But the interesting thing is, originally, it was a female gorilla who falls in love with Lou. And the only complaint the Breen office had about the censorship in this film, about the material, was the fact that there was bestiality implied with the female gorilla. So they had to make it a male gorilla who just is so beholden to him for saving him from the pit.
Wow.
Yeah. So Lou has a friend, but he's totally afraid of the gorilla.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, Bud is walking around looking for the diamonds, and he runs into our next jungle star. And by the way, you notice I didn't talk about Buddy Bear. It's because we're going to save him for Jack and the Beanstalk, where he plays the giant.
Yep.
So just know that Buddy was also a heavyweight boxer, not as quite as good as his brother. Never was a champ, but has an incredible record. But we'll talk about him. Also a good singer, believe it or not. So where were we? The gorilla. Now, the gorilla is played by my favorite gorilla suit guy. And my apologies to the gorilla guy I worked with in Bride of Finkelstein, the Biffle and Schuster short on Kino Lorber DVD, The Misadventures of Biffle and Schuster. I worked with Academy Award winner Chris Whalis, who won for Gremlins. And he built the gorilla costume and played the gorilla in our movie. I always felt that every comedian should work with a gorilla, and that was my time. So anyway, Charles Gamora, born in 1903 in the Philippines. His name was Carlos Cruz Gamora. He stowed away on a ship to San Francisco, worked picking fruit, moved down to Los Angeles, set up a little stand outside Universal Studios, and he drew people's portraits. He was quite the artist and sculptor. And they noticed him in Universal, and they hired him for the sculpture department. And some of those what are they called? The ugly things.
The gargoyles.
The gargoyles he designed for Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yeah.
He also did work on Phantom of the Opera and a few other things. His first gorilla was in 1928, a movie called The Leopard Lady. And he appears as a gorilla with Our Gang and Bear Shooters, with Laurel and Hardy in The Chimp, and again, very memorably, in Swiss Miss, mm-hmm. meeting them on the bridge as they're moving the piano. Lon Chaney's movie, The Unholy Three, Road to Zanzibar with Hope and Crosby, and with Lugosi in Murders of the Rue Morgue. He was the murderer, the the gorilla. He was quite the makeup man, by the way, and sculptor, mm-hmm. like I said. He was a Martian in War of the Worlds, and in I Married a Monster from Outer Space, a very good movie, despite that crazy title.
Yeah.
He died of a heart attack very young, at the age of 58, while he was doing makeup for one of the first I ever saw in a movie theater, Jack the Giant Killer, in 1963, I believe it was. So yeah, that's Charlie Gamora. He's also the gorilla in At the Circus with the Marx Brothers. For years, Groucho told a lying story, a fictitious story about the gorilla suit and poking holes in it and whatever. It's a lot of
money. Yeah.
So, okay. They're talking to Frank Buck. Okay. So who's Frank Buck? I almost passed him. Hey, I passed the buck.
Yeah.
come on, please. Frank Buck, born in 1884 in Gainesville, Texas. He's famous for his best-selling book, Bring Him Back Alive. He actually fell into it quite by accident. He went to South America, I believe it was, and he started collecting these animals. And eventually he sold them at a profit. And he thought, hey, I can do this. This is good. This kind of feeds into my love of adventure. And he was a hunter, you know, and all this mm-hmm. stuff. He was a public relations man, which of course helped him push his own career. He made 7 movies between 1932 and 1943. He brought back 100,000 species alive, you know, for various zoos and things like that. But also he brought back the monkeys for experimentation. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, I wanted to see Frank Buck fall into the gorilla pit. I really have written here, and please forgive my French again, but I wrote monkeys for labs, and I wrote asshole. Lived in Encino, California, next to character actor Charles Wininger. There's some trivia for you. Died of lung cancer at the age of 66, and he has the flattest nose this side of Sammy Davis Jr. Listen, babe, he is... I mean, seriously, it's like somebody took a brick and smashed it against his nose. And when he turns in profile, you see it. It's just, it's one of the wonders of the world, one of the eight wonders of the world. And there's something I didn't know. I'm a Long Island boy. I don't know if you knew that, but he had a jungle land in Amityville, Long Island. I had no idea. It probably closed before I did. So Frank Buck, they meet Frank Buck, and he's a bad actor. And, you know, and apparently I heard that Frank Buck and Clyde Beatty didn't get along. And it was very interesting that they took all the publicity pictures together, that mm-hmm. they were very cold to one another. So anyway, now the diamonds play into it. The gorilla is involved. And I have to tell you, the scene that got me laughing the most was when they sit down to eat lunch and Lou sees the gorilla in the bushes and nobody sees it. It's like Frank Buck took Bud Abbott pills and the two of them are just sort of staring down at their food while Lou sees the gorilla and is doing scare takes times 10. Mm-hmm. When he's missing his mouth with the food, I lost it. I completely lost it. And then when he almost kills himself with the knife, he can't control his. It reminds me of Dr. Strangelove. It's Dr. Strangelove. It is so funny, and he is just absolutely brilliant. He is just, I don't know where he got that energy from, but I will tell you this, after the next movie they made, he was out for a year with rheumatic fever. Mm. Poor Lou. Anyway, so they sit down to eat, and Lou sees this, and he goes through these gyrations with his fork and the plate and everything else. And of course, Bud and Frank Buck just have no idea what's going on. So anyway, and of course, when they turn to look, the gorilla is gone. Anyway, there's the scene where they go swimming. They want to go swimming.
Mm-hmm.
And it has probably the most awkward close-up of Bud Abbott I've ever seen in any movie. And it always makes me uncomfortable.
Really?
I need a life. He's warning Lou about, you know, be sure to dive into the netted area. That way the alligators keep out and, you know, you'll be safe. So when Lou does jump into the water, they cut to Bud in close-up saying, "Ugh, what a belly flop. Ugh, what a belly flop."
Yes.
And it wasn't a belly flop. He jumped right in, you know. It was like, it looked like, oh boy, we need to cover something. So Bud, say this. it just doesn't work.
No.
Another thing I didn't mention is that they were ostensibly, Hillary and her gang, and I don't mean the Clintons, are looking for ostensibly the orangutan gargantua or the gargantua orangutan.
No. Orangutan gargantua, yeah.
The orangutan gargantua. Of course, there's not an orangutan in Africa at all, but maybe the gargantua, yes. But this will tell you something. This is interesting. It's described in the movie as 20 feet tall, looking very human, with a very human face. And they were planning on doing the animation, the Nassar brothers. They were thinking early on that they would create a monster with animation. And apparently they didn't. In the end, it was too expensive. So it turns out just to be a bigger version of the gorilla.
It's
the same suit.
Yes.
Right? So anyway, when they get caught by natives, Bud and Lou get caught by natives, and they're tied up, and of course, there are two pots to boil them in, and one is short and fat, and the other one is tall and thin, which I love. It's a great picture. Unfortunately, it was done in 1930 at Universal for a Coens and the Kellys movie with George Sidney and Charlie Murray. You get this information here on this podcast, ladies and gentlemen, whether you want it or not.
Yeah.
But I can't remember the name of that one. So they've got the pot, they're there. The gorilla saves them from the natives. There's a big chase. And what I like is when Lou walks under the orangutan gargantua, you only see the spread in the legs. And it looks like, you know, like a trellis, like he's walking through a trellis. And then when the natives run and they look up, you see it's the giant gorilla. Mm-hmm. And the most tasteful gag in the movie is play it out for us as all the African-American natives look up. They become so frightened, they turn white.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just letting that settle in. Okay. Now, you know what? Back in 1949, I'm sure that got a huge laugh, not only from white people, but from black people as well.
Yep.
It was a different time, folks. It just was. And I try not to be offended by this stuff because of that. You have to use logic here. It was a different time. Things were not always peachy keen, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to break that to all of you. But anyway, that's the gag. And then when Lou turns around and sees the gorilla, his eyebrows are animated. And they go way up and way down and way up and way down. And it's the weirdest thing. It's the weirdest close-up of Lou Costello you will ever see in your life. And there is makeup over his real eyebrows, so he looks weird. It's
yes.
So anyway, that's the last we see of the orangutan gargantua.
Yes.
And Lou runs away. And here's the deal. None of the crooks really get a comeuppance. They were really ready to murder Bud and Lou and steal the money and steal the diamonds and all this stuff. Hillary is caught in one of Frank Buck's cages, but she's okay. They let her out and they say, you know, it's too dangerous out here. You stay with us. That's the last you see of Hillary.
Yes.
Two behemoths were knocked out by monkeys, by coconuts from the trees on their heads. So they're unconscious, but they're not in police custody.
Well, one thing I like about that scene, you know, it's the old gag where it's the two guys there in the jungle and the one monkey throws a coconut and, you know, Buddy turns to Max and says, what'd you hit me for? I didn't hit you. And then another coconut comes in. And before they start going at each other, Buddy makes a comment like, I can't remember the line exactly, but it's, I'll hit you harder than Lewis ever did.
That's it. That's the line. I was just going to say that. But you see, Max had a sense of humor. He was a fun boy. You know?
Yeah.
I love that line. I really
yes.
do. I love that line. The truth of the matter is, as I was watching, though, that Buddy is not a very good actor. Max really is a natural.
But yeah.
Buddy is kind of, you know, a lox. He's good as the giant, but he just has to, like, growl and stuff.
Well, yeah, that's a very one-note kind of a character. So, and he
yes.
does it well.
It's true, yeah.
He has to stand there and be big. And, you know, he does that very well.
Yes, he does. He's a natural at that, yes. He's very tall. He's a very tall man.
Yes.
He should come with a fire escape. So anyway, I did leave out the scene that got the biggest response from audiences in 1949.
Okay.
Not just biggest response. They couldn't hear the dialogue. The laughter was so great. And that was the old, I'll dress up as a lion and I'll make you look brave and blah, blah,
yep.
blah. Now, it is much better in this than it is in Naughty 90s.
Yes.
Because that cockamamie bear outfit. But in this one, you know, for some reason they have a lion skin along on this safari. Doesn't everybody?
Of course. Yeah.
You've got to have a lion skin. So, and for some reason, and this is why it's one of their independent movies, because they would have never gotten away with this at Universal. For some reason, Bud, you know what? Everybody's talking about you being a coward. I'm a little tired of hearing this. Since when, Bud? So we're going to make you look brave in front of everybody. So again, it's the thing from, some trace it back to Commedia dell'arte, but it was done by Clark and McCullough at the turn of the century, and mm-hmm. I mean the 19th century, and they're doing it here, and it was the biggest hit of the film.
Wow.
Bud, of course, sees a real lion. He faints. Lou ends up in a cage with a real lion. The mat work is excellent. The mm-hmm. rear projection work is excellent. And it is. It's funny. And the funniest thing is when Lou is laughing and he sees Bud and the laughter turns to tears. That is maybe my favorite thing that Lou Costello does. And I have to tell you, even Tom Ewell, the great actor Tom Ewell, who was with them in Lost in Alaska, he told an interviewer, he said, you know something? Lou Costello does something I've never seen anyone do. Not since he did it, and I've never seen it. He could go from laughter to tears, you know, with that whole transition. He
yeah.
was so impressed. And to be honest with you, I've tried it. It's not easy.
No, it's not.
You have to be really good. You have to be a really good actor. And seriously, it's so funny. It really is funny. So anyway, then that leads into one of my favorite scenes where Bud thinks Lou is dead and he's going off about how I treated him so badly. And they did it in Abbott and Costello in Hollywood.
Yep.
But I have to tell you, this is much better. It's mm-hmm. Bud is just going off and he is fantastic.
Yes.
And Lou gets the slap in the face at the end. You know, why you double cross it? fun scene, but we better get going. We better get moving now. So it turns out Bud's a real rat in this one. Again, he becomes crazed with money and the diamonds, and he leaves Lou behind in Africa. And I have to tell you, that last shot of Lou walking away on his own is sad. It's very
yes.
sad.
Yes,
because Bud's
is.
Like, I don't want to see you again. Just stay away from me. Blah, 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 blah. And he rows away and that's it. And it fades away. It fades out. But then when it fades in, we see the Livington building. Lou's name is Stanley Livington in this. And he's got his own building and it's a huge skyscraper. And he's dressed to the nines and he's got a cane, a silver tipped cane. And he's rich. And obviously he found the diamonds and he gets into the elevator, and who's the elevator operator? Bud.
Yep.
You know, Bud must have had no ego at all. You know what I mean? None whatsoever. Because, you know, there are certain people that would not do something like this.
Yeah.
Or not present themselves in a dark light like that. A dark light.
And what I love is all he can say is, I can't understand it.
I can't understand. But what a great ending. You know, when he says,
yes.
By the way, Mr. Livingston, did you think about that raise I asked for? And he goes, well, I'll tell you, I'll talk it over with my partner. And he opens up the door and the gorilla is sitting there and he's playing with building blocks. And Lou turns around and says, he's in, my partner's in. And the gorilla takes the blocks and spells out the end. And that's it.
There's a throwaway gag in the lobby of the hotel that I really enjoy. You know, Lou, obviously big businessman, dressed to the nines, as you say, he comes into the lobby. Everybody's greeting him. Hey, Mr. Livingston. Good morning, Mr. Livingston. And he goes up to the newsstand in the lobby. And the girl that's there, you know, he says, my paper, please. And she hands him a comic book.
And he hides it in his coat.
Yes.
And he plays gin rummy with the elevator boy. Right. And
yeah.
He says, how much do I owe you? And he goes, 22 cents. And he goes, I'll see you at 2 o'clock. So a good, funny ending. And Bud was a good sport. To tell you the truth now, it's not my least favorite film anymore. I have to say, after seeing this gorgeous print, and I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah.
It's just, they did a remarkable job. And it's a fun movie. It's a fun little movie. Again, I don't think it's a great Abbott and Costello. I think it's 3 stars. I think that would be generous of me to give it 3 stars. It still reminds me of their TV show a little too much. And when I say that, I mean a little thrown together, or a little episodic. They did do this on their TV show when they went to find Bingo's Fada in the Congo. Was it the Congo? Where is it? But yeah, I think it was.
I think Congo. It was, yeah.
Yeah, the Belgian Congo, I think they were saying, or something like that. Anyway, so
man,
they go
to. It's been a while.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a different gorilla too. It's not Charlie Gamora. I don't know who it was, but anyway, so they did it in 24 minutes, and this movie was like 90 minutes. So
yeah,
it's not the same story, but it's kind of the same gags. He does the scared thing when they're eating, and he sees the gorilla, and they do the thing where Bud dresses up as a gorilla. And they do the cage thing. So they took the best of this movie and put it into the TV show. And I think that's why people love the TV show, because it's condensed like soup. And
just add water.
Just add water. Liquid water. Just add water. So anyway, what are your final thoughts, Jerry, on this film?
Well, it has never ranked as low on my list as you have said, but yeah, it's not one of my all-time favorites of theirs. I've enjoyed it, and I honestly think, especially in my younger days, just having Joe Besser and Shemp Howard there was enough of a treat to make a stand out a little bit in my mind. And I'm in agreement with you. The lion skin. And the I've Lost My Best Friend are done so well in this one.
Yeah.
That really elevates it a little bit to me.
Yeah, I agree. And also, I was going to mention something else. You were talking about the gags of Besser and Shemp.
Besser and Shemp.
Yeah. Again, that to me, it's more of a disappointment. I mean, it's fun to see. Joe has more to do. He's definitely a supporting character, whereas Shemp pops in like every 10, 15 minutes.
But he pops in every 10, 15 minutes in It Ain't Hay.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
But he's got much better material in that one.
Well, yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I do find him very funny. It's funny when he's walking with the monkey. He thinks it's Lou and it's the monkey. And what, he's trying to do, make a monkey out of me? and the outtake to that is just... it's classic. It's typical Shemp nonsense. He's walking and the monkey starts acting up a little bit and he goes, what's the matter with you? What, have you been eating olives or something? I mean, what does that mean? he's out of control. But what a shame that he died so young. A shame. And kids, he did not die of a heart attack. He died of a cerebral hemorrhage. He stroked out, just like his brother Curly.
Yep.
And not his brother Mo, who handed out the punishment. All right. Anyway, that's for later. No, get the new book about Shemp by Burt Kearns. And I'm all through it. And we talk about that. I actually say that I think Mo helped facilitate his brother's deaths.
Mm.
How about that?
Wow.
Anyway, we'll discuss that later.
Yes, on our Shemp Howard podcast. We'll take care
That's right. Well, you know, we were talking about this gang, and somebody, in fact, one of our fans asked what we were going to do once we finished with the movies. And I told him that, you know, I'd like to look at the TV shows. I'd like to look at the Colgate shows, not maybe one at a time, but, you know, season by season.
Yeah.
And then look at their radio work. And then once we're done with Abbott and Costello, I would just love to turn this into a classic comedy podcast. We'll pick a movie, maybe even take votes from people, and we will discuss them, just like we're doing all the Abbott and Costello movies.
Yep.
So that's what I'm thinking.
That sounds like a fantastic idea, because I know you and I have said many times, doing this podcast is a lot of fun. And when it stops being fun, that's when we'll stop doing this.
That's when you stop.
And we aren't even close to that happening yet.
Oh,
so
please. I'm having such a ball. These past 2 days, oh my God, I've been doing research like crazy. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't easy with this one because, like I said, I'm not that familiar with it. I was going to ask you, this is what I was going to ask you, Jerry.
Yeah.
When did you first see this film? Because I didn't know it existed, like I said, until Jim's thing. And then I didn't see it until I moved to Los Angeles when I was in my early 20s.
You know, it may actually have been on LA TV that I first saw it as well.
That's possible.
About the same time in my early 20s, yeah, I moved out to LA as well. And that's probably it because, you know, growing up, as you did in the Boston market, we always had Abbott and Costello were on every Saturday night, but it was just the Universals.
Right.
And
right.
Not even all of the Universals, apparently.
Right. That's true. My big revelations were It Ain't Hay, which I hadn't seen, you know, until they started showing it on the Sunday mornings.
Yeah.
And Africa Screams, had no idea. And there was another one that never popped up. You know, the first time I saw One Night in the Tropics was kind of late in the game as well. You know?
And but you anyway. See, for me, it was the MGMs. Lost in a Harem and Go to Hollywood.
Right. Oh, Rio Rita, too. Probably.
Yeah. I have to say, I did not see Rio Rita until maybe 2 years ago.
Wow.
Yes. Wow. It was that elusive. I finally found it. I think somebody had posted it on some website somewhere. First place I saw it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, had to go buy it. You know, after that, but still.
It's a goodie. It's definitely a goodie.
It is.
I'm trying to think. They showed it, the MGMs on CBS, the affiliate network in New York, and they showed the three MGMs, but they only showed Rio Rita once that I remember. The other two would come around maybe once a year. Rio Rita was shown late at night, one Saturday night, and I was up with my tape recorder, you know, taping the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I absolutely loved it. I mean, I didn't like the songs, but I really enjoyed them in the movie. It's primo, Abbott and Costello, you know?
Yeah, man. Yeah, I saw Dance With Me, Henry long before I ever saw Rio Rita.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
Oh, boy. Well, I actually like Dance With Me, Henry, so we're going to make a lot of enemies.
It's nice. No, I agree with you. But then I'm a Mary Wicks fan from day one. So, you know.
who isn't?
Yes.
She's got that honker on her. I'll tell you. She looks like, you hold her by the ankles, you could hit a golf ball. You know? She has got that honker. But anyway, she is terrific. And so are you, Jerry, if you don't mind my saying so.
I don't mind you saying so, especially since I would turn it right around and say it back to you. You are terrific, my friend.
Thank you, my friend. And congratulations on a healthy run of Something Rotten.
Yes, it was. It was a lot of fun.
I know you worked very hard.
I did, trying to keep up with, you know, people one-third my age. It was with a college production, and I was the guest artist. So having to match the energy of these college students, my gosh, if it had run another week, I think I would have died.
I like college productions because I get collagen.
There you are. Right.
But anyway, that's where I stay, at the College Inn. Okay, so I think we should possibly let these people go home now. And I'll wish you a hearty good evening to you, Jerry, and a good week. And we will wait breathlessly for this episode.
Yeah,
and you, I just hope you're doing very well. How did your auditions go the other day?
Oh,
the two of them.
Yes, very well. We were casting 12 one-act plays for this one Playwrights Festival at our local mm-hmm. theater here. And we had about 50 or 60 people show up to audition.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a community. That's a real community. That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I'm very, very happy to hear that. Yeah. Okay. I'm hoping someday I'll be able to let loose again and thrill an audience
you
with
will.
My presence. I want to work with you is what I want to do. All right. Well, on that note, we will say a fond farewell and enjoy yourself. And please watch an Abbott and Costello movie. You'll be glad you did.